Good afternoon, everybody. You're all very welcome to an unusually well-attended third term event at the LSE. As you know, normally at the LSE we are scouting around to fill a row or two at exam time. I like to think this isn't a comment on a lackadaisical attitude to exams, but is instead a reflection of the seriousness of the topic. Because we have so many, I know that it's not necessary to say it to any of the students, because we have so many of the media here and they live by their mobile phones and various other electronic apparatus, could I ask everybody to just make sure that they've turned off their mobile phones? Thank you very much. The very first thing to say about this occasion is that it wouldn't be taking place without an organisation that we used to think of as discreet, but which, through the force of extraordinary circumstance, has become highly visible. And that organisation is the International Committee of the Red Cross. The Centre for the Study of Human Rights has a long association with the International Committee, and it is our tremendous good fortune to have a working partnership with them, which means that, for example, through their commitment, an occasion of this significance can take place. And whilst none of our four speakers is directly associated with as a member of the International Committee, we are very lucky to have representing the committee our legal advisor, Emanuela Chiara Gillard, who is right here and will be contributing briefly after. Thank you, sir, for beginning a round of applause. Our speakers are all, it is fair to say, experts in this field. And the speakers will speak for 10 minutes, possibly rising to 15. Our first speaker is Christopher Greenwood, who is a professor of international law here at the LSE, a joint editor of the International Law Reports and other books, and is also a member of the bar and needs, I think, genuinely no further introduction. I'll introduce each other speaker as we go along, but Chris, over to you on the topic of human rights and humanitarian law in occupied Iraq.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For one horrible moment when I came into this room and saw the advertisement for tomorrow's meeting, I thought I was being expected, first of all, to talk about Wither America, a particularly difficult topic, especially since in one of the earlier flyers for the same meeting, Wither was spelt with only one H towards the end rather than the one at the beginning as well. I'm sure that the size of the audience does not in fact reflect a lackadaisical attitude towards exams, but I can assure you, Mr. Chairman, that my acceptance of your invitation had a lot to do with the fact that anything that gets me away from marking the exams must be regarded as a good thing. Now, in classical Greek theatre, ladies and gentlemen, it was the custom before the heavy melodrama to have a little one-act play. And I am the little one-act play this evening before the clash of titans of human rights law against the world's only superpower that is about to come before you. My task is simply to set the scene. And I'm going to do so, as I've been asked to, in only 10 minutes, by making just four brief points about the general principles of human rights and humanitarian law in occupied Iraq. Now, the first of those points is that the legal position in Iraq today has nothing whatever to do with the legality or illegality of the resort to force last year. Now, that follows from two very well-established principles. The first is that it's a general principle of international humanitarian law that the operation of the law of belligerent occupation, which is what we are principally concerned with here, applies irrespective of whether the occupation is lawful or unlawful. And secondly, the application of human rights law is not dependent on or affected by the legality or illegality of any prior resort to force. If there were any room for doubt about that, however, it is, I think, removed by the fact that the Security Council, after the use of force had taken place, after the principal military operations had taken place, passed Resolution 1483, which lays down a framework for the occupation of Iraq by the coalition authority. So if you view the recourse to force against Iraq last year as an illegal act of aggression, that does not render the subsequent occupation of Iraq unlawful. Conversely, if you think that the use of force against Iraq was legal, and that has always been my view, that fact does not confer any additional powers upon the coalition states or relieve them of the need to comply with any applicable principles of humanitarian law or the law of human rights. Having said that, let's then turn to the question, what are the applicable principles of international law? And I think they fall into three different categories, and those three categories are my three remaining points for those of you who are keeping a scorecard of how far we're getting towards the end. The first is the law of belligerent occupation, that area of the law of armed conflict, or humanitarian law, that regulates the situation when one state takes control of part of the territory of another in the course of armed conflict. And that law is to be found primarily in the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, customary international law, as codified in the Hague Regulations on the Laws and Customs of War on Land of 1907, but not in additional Protocol 1 of 1977. That text is not applicable to the current situation in Iraq because Iraq was not a party to the protocol and therefore it didn't apply to the hostilities last year. Now, the main principles of occupation law which have to be taken into account is that the starting point is that an occupying power is not a liberal democracy. The law of belligerent occupation is based on the assumption that what you have here is a military regime whose primary concern is going to be the military concerns of its own security. And it is entitled to take action going far beyond what is normally permitted to a government under the day-to-day law of human rights, in order to preserve the security of itself and its armed forces. But it certainly doesn't have an unlimited power in this regard. It has a duty to govern the occupied territory. Simply sitting back and letting the mayhem carry on is not a legal option for an occupying power. It's not simply that it has a right to govern the occupied territory, it's got a legal duty to do so. Moreover, its duty is to do so while respecting, unless absolutely prevented, the laws in force prior to the start of the occupation. Now, that last provision can be extremely difficult to apply where you have a prolonged belligerent occupation, as, for example, you have in Palestine, or where you have an occupation which takes place after the complete collapse of the government of one of the warring parties, and in circumstances where the occupying power is trying to bring about a reconstruction of the occupied territory, such as you have in these circumstances. I just make two brief points about that. The first is that occupation does not affect sovereignty over the occupied territory. When you read in the press that on the 30th of June this year, the coalition states will be returning sovereignty to Iraq, that is, with the greatest of respect, a massive misunderstanding. Sovereignty has never been anywhere other than with Iraq. What the occupation powers have is a temporary power of government or control over the occupied territory. They don't have sovereignty, and therefore they haven't got anything to return in that respect. The second point is that the phrase, unless absolutely prevented, in relation to the governance of occupied territory and respect for the existing law in force, has always been given a rather liberal interpretation. That's liberal with the smallest of small L's. For example, in the closing months of World War II, the Allied powers in occupation of parts of Germany took the view that they were absolutely prevented from applying Nazi racial legislation in force in Germany at the time that the occupation began. I think one would probably agree with that understanding of the law. Let me turn from that to the second applicable body of law, or potentially applicable body, and that's the international law of human rights. Now, the relationship between international humanitarian law, the law of war, and international human rights law is the subject of many a learned PhD dissertation, and an extremely useful topic to bone up for exams, if you're in the process of doing so at the moment. It's been the subject of considerable controversy. There are some who take the view that once you enter into the world of armed conflict, human rights law simply has no part to play at all. In other words, human rights law deals with situations of peace and normality. The law of armed conflict is the law that comes into operation once the fighting starts. That's the view which, for example, seems to have been attributed to the United States government in respect of proceedings in the inter-American human rights bodies connected with the Guantanamo Bay detainees. In my view, that kind of bright line approach is exceptionally difficult to reconcile with a number of considerations of law, particularly the fact that most human rights treaties contain express provision allowing states to derogate from them, or rather to derogate from some of their provisions, in time of war or other national emergency. Well, if you can derogate from some provisions in time of war, that suggests two things. First of all, if you don't derogate, the provisions are applicable. And secondly, if you can only derogate from some of the provisions, the ones you can't derogate from apply in war in any event. Secondly, the American position over Guantanamo appears to me to be impossible to reconcile with the approach taken by the International Court of Justice in its advisory opinion on nuclear weapons. However opaque that opinion may be in some respects, it quite clearly applies or deals with the application of human rights law in time of armed conflict. So I come to the conclusion that international human rights law is far from irrelevant to the situation once an armed conflict has begun. But having said that, one has to ask the question whether human rights law will nevertheless apply in its entirety to downtown Basra as though it were Kettering or Wolverhampton. And I think the short answer to that is no. First of all, with the European Convention on Human Rights, there is at least a question mark over how far it is applicable outside the European states. In the case of Bankovic, some 2 years ago, the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights unanimously decided that the convention was not applicable to the bombardment by NATO states of targets in Yugoslavia during the Kosovo conflict. Now, on the other hand, the court in Bankovic upheld an earlier decision in a case called Loizidu, which decided that the European Convention was applicable to Turkey's occupation of northern Cyprus. But of course, it's not quite clear what the rationale for the Loizidu case is in this respect. One of the grounds put forward in that case was that northern Cyprus and its inhabitants were subject to the convention before the occupation started, and both the occupying power, Turkey, and the occupied state, Cyprus, were parties to the European Convention. Now, that's plainly not the case in Iraq, and it remains to be seen how far the relationship between Bankovic and Loizidu will be reconciled in the future. There may also be a difference between the situation in respect of occupied territory generally and the situation in respect of, say, prisoners detained by one of the occupying powers. The UN Human Rights Committee has recently taken the view in a general comment that the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is applicable in any event to the detention of prisoners outside the territory of a party to the covenant. The other question one has to ask about human rights law in Iraq is how far it can be applied in practice in a situation which is so radically different from the situation you find in any of the European states. And the last area of international law which has a bearing here is the lex specialis laid down in the relevant Security Council resolutions, resolutions 1483 and 1511 in particular. And I've time for only one brief comment in respect of that. Resolution 1483 lays down, it authorizes the governance of Iraq by the occupying powers. But in contrast to the situation in Kosovo, it does so within the framework of the law of belligerent occupation. It doesn't, in other words, shunt the law of belligerent occupation to one side. Though it does, in my view, in some respects, prevail over it. For example, in imposing a duty to engage in the reconstruction of civil government within Iraq. Now, that suggests that there is a degree of uncertainty about the scope and content of the legal regime that applies in Iraq. Let me make quite clear, I don't, however, think that that uncertainty makes any difference to certain fundamental questions. And I conclude by saying that the photographs that have been in the press recently of the ill-treatment of detainees, that ill-treatment of the kind depicted in those photographs, that's both the photographs that are real and the photographs that are invented, ill-treatment of that kind could not be justified under any regime of international law. And that, I think, is a convenient point at which to leave it.
Thank you very much, Chris. Our next speaker is Professor Françoise Hampson, who is a person of many roles, an independent expert member of the UN Subcommission on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights, a consultant on humanitarian law to the International Committee of the Red Cross, co-director of a Centre for Children and Armed Conflict Monitoring at Essex, and governor of the British Institute of Human Rights. So, Françoise, with a special welcome to somebody from Essex Centre to the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the warm-up act. I'll hire him again. I don't disagree with anything he said. It doesn't necessarily mean I agree with everything. There's a subtle distinction there. There's one exception, and the exception is when he said that this might be useful to students revising for exams. Those students here from the University of Essex disregard that. I will consider the applicability of the law of armed conflicts, which is my preferred term, and human rights law in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I will consider the application, as opposed to the applicability, of both regimes with regard to three specific issues: changing the political or economic structure of an occupied territory, the status of detainees and status determination, and what to do next about the problem of ill-treatment. I want to raise initially, though, a problem with the abstract, and I appreciate many of you will not have seen that. The abstract about this session gave the impression it's a choice of humanitarian law or human rights law. I agree with Professor Greenwood that that is not the case. Simply because the law of armed conflict applies does not necessarily mean in and of itself that human rights law is not applicable. So when is the law of armed conflicts applicable? In particular, I think there's a problem with regard to the current situation in Afghanistan. When the operation was embarked upon, it was an armed conflict between two states, or more than two states, between the coalition and the Taliban, who governed most of Afghanistan. The issue of recognition was not relevant. It was clearly an armed conflict between two or more states, therefore it was an international armed conflict. That bit's easy. But what about the situation after the change of government and the installation of a new government? I'm not dealing with the issue of ISAF, I'm dealing with the question of the US forces working in the area on the borders between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Is that subject, that fighting, to international humanitarian law or the law of armed conflict? And if so, of what type? And in what order do you ask the questions? I think the first question is there an armed conflict going on? It would appear from the degree of organization of the fighters, the nature of the fighting, and the scale of the fighting, that can appropriately be called an armed conflict. But is it international or non-international? The US forces are certainly not acting on behalf of the Afghan government. In that sense, they're not, as it were, Afghan-style armed forces. So it's not a classic internal armed conflict. But equally, if an international armed conflict has to be between two or more states, which is the other state that the United States is fighting? It might be tempting to say Pakistan, but I think that would be misleading. So I'm not clear what the status is of the current fighting in eastern Afghanistan, and I'd be very interested in hearing the views of the ICRC. As far as Iraq is concerned, it was clearly an international armed conflict followed by belligerent occupation, during the course of which there have been occasional outbreaks of fighting of such intensity and nature that they may be appropriately called little armed conflicts, e.g. Fallujah. What about human rights law? There I agree essentially with what Professor Greenwood said. The key question is not actually does it matter that it's outside national territory. The key question is in what circumstances does a victim of, or alleged victim of a human rights violation come within the jurisdiction of the state when it's acting outside national territory? The case law of the European Court of Human Rights and the Human Rights Committee's general comment make it very clear that human rights obligations apply in occupied territory. In addition, they apply where an individual is under the effective control of a state acting outside national borders. A classic example will be the detention of Öcalan. So, what about the situation in Iraq? Iraq is, and has been since approximately the 1st of May last year, occupied territory. Therefore, it would appear, but I suspect this is going to be subject to judicial challenge, it would appear that, generally speaking, the powers running Iraq, effectively, I don't mean they're running it effectively, I mean they're effectively running Iraq, those powers are bound by their human rights obligations, and since they have not taken the trouble to derogate, they're bound, apparently, by them in their entirety, because the Cyprus-Turkey decision of the European Commission of Human Rights makes it clear, if you don't derogate, you are bound by the treaty in its entirety. And in that case, under the European Convention on Human Rights, you can't detain POWs, interestingly. You can if you derogate. In addition, whether or not it is applicable human rights law as in occupied territory, where you are dealing with detainees, it is also applicable because of the extent of the control you are exercising over the particular individuals. The three issues I wanted to touch on. Professor Greenwood mentioned the question of whether or not you have to apply the previously applicable law and gave the example of a non-application of offensive domestic law. My problem isn't that. My problem is attempting to change the political and economic order of Iraq by privatizing national assets. That is prohibited under the Fourth Geneva Convention. It is absolutely clear that there is no way in which that can be justified. Those decisions are for the people of Iraq to make and not for occupying powers to make on their behalf. The question of the status of detainees, whether in Afghanistan or in Iraq. Here I disagree with the American position. To me, it seems clear that under international law, including customary law insofar as the relevant provisions in the protocol are customary law, there are two animals. There are combatants and there are civilians. There is no such legal animal as an unlawful combatant. There are civilians who unlawfully take part in hostilities. When they are unlawfully take part in hostilities, they can be targeted. They can also be tried for taking part in hostilities, unlike a member of the armed forces who can't be tried simply for fighting. But there is no animal known as an unlawful combatant. Why might states be tempted to create such an animal? If you have an unlawful combatant, it means you can fire at him any day, any hour of the day, any day of the week, whatever he is doing, because that's true in relation to armed forces. And it means he can't fire back. Unfortunately, the law of armed conflict is based on the very sensible notion of reciprocity. Not in the sense of each side has to formally commit itself, but it's based on the equality of belligerents. If you start saying, we have the right to fire at you, and you don't have the right to fire on us, then the chances of respect for the rules is going to be undermined. When it comes to the detainees actually being detained, and the question arises of what their status is, in particular, whether they're prisoners of war or not, there is a provision set out in the Third Geneva Convention on how you decide these issues. You don't decide by executive fiat. You decide by, if there is any doubt, going along to a tribunal and letting the tribunal reach a decision. There is a doubt if a guy says he's a civilian and you think he's a combatant. There is a doubt if you think he's a civilian and he claims to be a combatant. You can't say, I'm certain that I know what he is, therefore he's that and there is no doubt. So there is a need for some form of independent mechanism for determining status. The third issue that I wanted to touch on very briefly is the question of the ill treatment of the detainees. Whether they are prisoners of war or ordinary criminals or civilians who unlawfully took part in the conflict doesn't matter. Torture, inhuman and degrading treatment is prohibited under both human rights law and under the law of armed conflict under Geneva Conventions 3 and 4. But I don't want to go over that ground again. I want to look at what happens next and the question of causation. If you are looking at why did the problem arise, don't fall into the trap of assuming, oh, well, that's what happens when the American military go in, because that is simply untrue. Since Vietnam, the American military have gone out of their way to institutionalize ways of giving effect to the rules. Admittedly, it's their interpretation of the rules, but they do take the rules very seriously. What has happened is an aberration. It is not the norm for US forces. Having said that, it is not a matter of the conduct simply of individuals. You don't get all that equipment, and you don't happen to stumble by accident on traditional ways of softening people up for interrogation. I think the causes, and I'm not speaking of strict causation in the legal sense here, I would identify two important causes. One, the complete failure to plan for what would happen after the armed conflict, in which case people find themselves doing all sorts of unexpected things and there was no planning in place. That is not the fault of the military, either the British or American military. They wanted to plan. They were told they weren't to engage in any such planning. The other cause in this broad sense of cause is the way in which, since 9/11, the US gives the impression of having torn up international law, most notably the Geneva Conventions and human rights law. They keep saying it doesn't apply. In fact, the position is that in various respects, the US is currently acting in violation of rules. It's not the rules are uncertain. The particular rules I'm referring to are clear. There are some rules, the scope of which is uncertain, but that is not true with regard to the issue of status determination, nor is it that there's any lack of clarity on the question of who is combatant and the fact that if you're not a combatant, you're a civilian and you may be fighting unlawfully. Those dilemmas, though, although those concepts, are clear. In asserting since 9/11 that the war on terror is outside every kind of previously known construct, the US, in effect, has torn up the rules that apply to those sorts of things. If you tear up some rules, it's not surprising then that your armed forces don't know whether it's okay if they humiliate people, don't know whether it's okay if you use dogs or not. So I think the causation is linked to that problem. There is no doubt that it's unlawful, and I'd like to issue a sort of challenge to Ruth as my final comment. I think there's only one way in which the US can show never again with regard to the ill treatment of detainees. The investigations are good, but they won't achieve never again. If the US means it, if they mean this should never happen again, they will ratify the American Convention on Human Rights, which contains the right of individual petition, or they will ratify the optional protocol to the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and give detainees the right to petition the Human Rights Committee. Ruth can hardly object. She sits on it. Thank you.
Well, moving seamlessly on, we have a most distinguished academic from the United States, currently Edward B. Burling, Professor of International Law and Diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced and International Studies, formerly in many other universities, greatly distinguished in the United States, but for present purposes worth saying, also U.S. member of the United Nations Human Rights Committee, member of the Secretary of State's Advisory Committee for International Law, member of the Defense Policy Board, Department of Defense, member of the CIA Historical Review Panel, and many other functions. So we are extremely pleased to have here this evening Professor Ruth Wedgwood.
And but what your kind chair didn't say also was I'm a crapped out economic history student from LSE. When I concluded my mathematics was not up to the new highfalutin modeling that economic history was about to engage in. Everybody here on the panel is a friend. The position of an American in some of these circumstances is always a touch awkward. So let me say where I certainly agree. First of all, you may want to read my quite heartfelt cri de coeur in the Washington Post Outlook section from the Sunday, which is available online, I guess, www.washingtonpost.com, which is about Abu Ghraib, and which indeed, after a morally neuralgic 2 weeks, was an attempt to come to account with what I think was to everybody, especially those of us who have Muslim members of our families, but everybody, a sense of horror and outrage at what had happened. Whatever arguable debate one may have about the difference between Geneva full tilt and the principles of Geneva, or the underlying ethos of Geneva, snapping at people with dogs without muzzles doesn't pass muster, obviously, under either. And the applicable law would include not simply the Geneva Conventions, which the U.S. has, in this case, conceded and should openly embrace the fact that they apply full tilt, but as well the Torture Convention. There are acts, I think, that occurred at Abu Ghraib that may extend beyond cruel, inhumane, and degrading to even rise to the level of the Torture Convention itself. And I have to say that I don't accept what seemed to be the suggestion made by a former member of the American administration on the McNeil-Lehrer report of 10 days ago, where it seemed to be in closing remarks that the view was taken that because the Torture Convention had only been incorporated into American law as to torture, but not as to cruel, inhuman, and degrading, that somehow relieved us of the responsibility for the latter half. And I do not accept that view. So even us nouvelle neocons have our limits, if I may put it that self-derisive way, because I am at heart still a lapsed liberal, and not more. So I do think that Abu Ghraib poses a great problem to restore a sense of sobriety, moral integrity, to regain the confidence of the Iraqi people. One federal judge I know who has dealt with a great many cases sent me an email, I will not tell you who, saying it same thing happens in American prisons quite often. And if you recall any of the conditions of confinement cases that have been litigated in the U.S., and I assume you have the same thing here now under the European Convention of arguing that conditions in jails can be so awful that they amount to cruel and unusual punishment. I think, in fact, Abu Ghraib may also be a time for a self-reflection as to whether things that we do at home shouldn't rise at least to the level of the law of occupation, much less human rights law. So I think this is a very serious moment. I do think it is a moment that has, if I may just wander off topic, Mr. Chair, for 2 seconds.
2 seconds.
well, not entirely off topic. Has some lessons, both bureaucratically and Francois quite properly said that the major way of preventing war crimes has always been and should always be training and doctrine and an inculcation of the sense of what it means to be an honorable person under arms. That the war crimes prosecutions after the fact are the least of it. Because truth to tell, as I always argue in my classes, most countries don't like accusing themselves. Jus in bello and jus ad bellum are seen as deeply linked. Even now, if you debate the status of Bomber Harries, you'll get a big hoopla in this country. The re-examination of the Dresden bombing, which is very much au courant in Germany, still here has a certain political tenor because I think the United Kingdom properly felt itself to be the victim of that war. So I think if you're going to have real jus in bello compliance, the major way to do it is by doctrinal changing, clear chains of command, inculcating, how should I say, at least the principles of Geneva, and certainly in most cases the rules, before the fact, to avoid this kind of breakdown, which may have been a combination of many, many things. I worry, if I may speak off the record for 2 seconds, that it could also be the case that in the felt need to generate intelligence in a difficult circumstance where the culture was not familiar to us, we don't have Arabic-speaking troops, except for Abizad, that the sense that you couldn't effectively use traditional ways of interrogation through psychological guile or fellow feeling with the interrogee may have led to this resort, which indeed I agree is wholly illegal, to physical force. So that said, I think there's no difference in Abba Graham. I think there may be some lessons elsewhere. But let me, if I may, just revert to what I thought the topic was on Iraq in general, law of occupation. One of the great controversies in America, generated by my dear old friend David Sheffer, who was the war crimes ambassador during the Rome conference and now is a itinerant law professor at Georgetown, was whether the attempt by the Allies to help the Iraqi people change their own institutions was in some way a violation of Geneva IV as occupying forces. And there is one oddity of the Geneva Conventions, which is that oftentimes our own behavior, both in World War II and currently, doesn't fit every jot and tittle of the rules. Because indeed, Geneva seems to say that you should leave the Iraqi institutions largely intact. But there clearly are reasons why you couldn't do that here. Number one, to have left them intact would have made the Allies into Saddam Hussein's enforcers. And if you had self-regarding Ba'athist institutions that applied a sanguinary criminal law and sent the riches of the state to a Ba'athist party structure, obviously to continue that with force of arms of allies under any aegis would amount to making us Saddam's enforcer. And human rights law surely must be taken in all cases as a interpretive source in reading Geneva IV reasonably. Secondly, I do think that when you read the Geneva Conventions, you have to take them against state practice. And they were written in 49, but they don't fit what happened in 45, or indeed what was still happening in 49, to wit, the whole project of the Allies, once it was rejected to make Germany simply a pastoral state, was to reconstruct German institutions, to reconstruct Japanese institutions. In Japan, you have the technical legal out that Japan had in some way agreed to it in the Potsdam Declaration. But nonetheless, clearly this was imposed upon Japan. In Germany, you can say it was debellatio. There was no German institution left, and therefore it wasn't really an occupation. Rather, the Allies were standing in the shoes of the German sovereign almost as a trustee, but not as an occupier. I don't think that will persuade anybody either who harkens to the Atlantic Charter and the agreement to have unconditional surrender. So I do think it's a troublesome curiosity, or more than a curiosity, that Geneva IV doesn't speak to what was the foundational transformations, the original democratic peace hypothesis, if you will, of the post-war reconstructions of Japan and Germany, and we have to reconcile that somehow. Third, I would just argue that if you're going to take the Geneva Conventions as foundational, as I believe ICRC does, the Red Cross, and one part of my op-ed over the weekend, I think appropriately celebrates the role of the ICRC. It's not just another NGO, with all respect to Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and Lawyers Committee. ICRC was there first and still has a singular role under the conventions and has at times a particular efficacy because it maintains perhaps too much a bit, but of the vow of silence that allows it to enter camps anywhere and then to raise their concerns with the detaining powers. But still, ICRC in general has not ever really wanted to draft new products until it sold the old ones. After Bosnia, where there clearly were very serious problems with prisoners of war, I used to tease Hans-Peter Gasser. When were they going to do Protocol 3 or 4 on prisoners of war in internal conflicts? And the view was that we really want to have universal accession to the old products before we generate new ones. But if we're going to then treat the existing Geneva Conventions as essentially constitutions, then I think they have to be read with the dynamism of a constitution, where you don't change the text, you change the understanding of the language in light of changed or developing circumstances. And surely, to my mind, item 3, if I may, experience of the UN in attempting over the last 10 years, halting and pathetic as sometimes it was, to transform the institutions in Bosnia and Kosovo and Timor, where essentially there was a multilateral occupying force after state collapse, has to be taken as one set of interpretive principles for how you'd read Geneva IV. To my mind, you should not suppose that the Security Council is ever so lawless that what it does lacks law jurisdictive effect. If something is done multilaterally with a sense of legitimacy, you shouldn't be surprised when states on their own choose to copy at least the beneficent aims that the multilateral community might have had. So I think, the narrow David Sheffer reading of Geneva IV has to be altered in light of what is now taken to be the right and certainly even the duty of the occupying power or to help a country find democratic institutions. And last but not least, the Iraqi people. Again, puzzling though it is how you construct a federal state which will make each of the communities feel secure. Puzzling though it is how you think about leavening Shia majoritarianism with Kurdish autonomy and Sunni human rights. Nonetheless, the attempt has been, halting as it is, to give the Iraqis a voice from the very beginning, and that is certainly the case in 1483 and 1511, the two foundational UN Security Council documents. So again, an occupation is something different, I think, if in fact the people in whom sovereignty never left, this is true, Philippe is right in that. Jane, we will cite in my case the American Constitution, I'm sorry, Christopher's right in that, excuse me. The famous...
two libel actions if you're not careful.
We've done one already. But the least world famous but most delicious theorist of the American Revolution was James Wilson. Famous for, by the way, also having said that it's the vocation of international law professors to tutor the people, since the people are the princes in democracies. But Wilson also said that quite obviously sovereignty never leaves the people. It can, the agent can disregard the rights of the principal, but it never leaves the people. So I think, in fact, when you have this expression of popular will alongside the authority that has the duty to keep order, as Fourth Geneva imposes upon the occupier, that you have quite a different situation. Now, on a couple of the other points that were raised, these are nettlesome and quarrelsome and important issues. My own view, and I've taken it, I will say, on principle in the committee, even if the committee doesn't always agree with me, that human rights law and LOAC, law of armed conflict, also known as international humanitarian law, have to be taken as close cousins, and each should inform the other. But I worry that if you simply say blunderbuss, that jot and tittle every locution in the covenant or in the Universal Declaration applies as a rule to LOAC, to situations of occupation or of war fighting. It's hard then, I think, for a layperson or an actor on the ground to make his or her way with any clarity. I mean, obviously the right to life, for example, is rather severely checkered by the right of one belligerent to take the lives with no probable cause hearing of his adversaries on the battlefield. So to my mind, clearly the law of armed conflict should be read differently after 50 years of human rights law. To that degree, the Geneva Conventions and Hague Conventions, Hague regulations need updating. But to say that you can simply quite literally take the Universal Declaration or the Covenant as a template to resolve all your problems will simply leave a sea of interpretive problems at hand. So me, I am a consociationalist. But I don't think that it necessarily is helpful to say that human rights law is applicable in the same sense that it is within a polity. On extraterritorial application, I take the point about black hole. I'm a great believer in the customary law of armed conflict, that even if human rights law doesn't apply, even if Geneva doesn't apply, certainly customary law applies, the Martens Clause applies, which invokes the principles of humanity and decency, certainly Common Article 3 applies, which has a certain rock bottom minima for the integrity of the body and of the human personality. But I do think that you're going to find among a number of nation states resistance to the proposition that the covenant necessarily applies offshore, that the covenant necessarily applies in wartime, although that is the doctrine of the committee in our new general comment. And finally, I didn't come here to talk about Guantanamo at all, but since it's been raised. I may be as common as current events reveal, occasionally naive. I think, at least in my mind, the original concern about literal application of Geneva was that there were some parts of the Geneva Conventions that didn't seem to fit very well to this kind of non-state adversary. If you had somebody who, for example, couldn't be demobilized, even when captured, who didn't fight for a state, who was continually dangerous, who didn't stand down the way that the German character in Grand Illusion stands down once the war is over for him, that some of the rules of Geneva were troublesome, like the inability to confine someone other than in the full precincts of a camp, or the inability to do anything that's unequal in treatment in order to gain intelligence. I think there may be a question, a serious debate to be had on whether if you think you can't apply all the rules of Geneva, that nonetheless, in terms of organizational learning, you may be better saying Geneva applies but will not apply the following rules, and here are the reasons why, than saying what might have seemed the more pure position, Geneva doesn't apply but will abide by Geneva principles, which has been the stated position of the U.S. government. Either way, you have a bit of a gray world. Either way, I think both a lawyerly sensibility and ethical commitment is fundamental. I do think that the dilemma that democracies feel themselves to face is that in trying to prevent future attacks, that the acquisition of intelligence is key, that there are human rights claims on both sides of the equation. I grew up in a suburb of New York City where national security was a dirty word, but I like to rather invoke the Velasquez-Rodriguez case, which says that the state has an affirmative human rights duty to protect its citizens against private violence, so that there may be times when you do have exquisitely painful dilemmas, almost philosophical dilemmas, about what to do in keeping true to the spirit of Geneva, the ambition of Geneva, but not veering into barbarity on anyone's side.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Our final speaker is a colleague of mine, professor of law, director of the Center in International Courts and Tribunals at UCL, a very distinguished author on environmental law, the co-founder of FIELD, and which is where he's a colleague of mine, a founder member of Matrix Chambers, very heavily involved in international law litigation, and just last year was made a Queen's Counsel. So we'll ask Philippe Sands to wind up the first part of the evening, please.
Thank you very much, Connor, and thank you to your colleagues at the Centre for the invitation and for the panel. I'm going to talk actually at a different level. I'm not going to talk about whether Rule X or Rule Y mechanically does or does not apply. I think we've had a very excellent discussion on that. I want to talk openly and frankly amongst friends because I know my co-panelists well, Ruth and Chris and Françoise, and I really want to put out the question, how is it that we have got ourselves into this deplorable situation? Because the situation really is quite astonishingly bad. We have a situation in which unknown numbers of thousands of people have died in Iraq. Our military, the American military, have no idea how many people have died. We have literally thousands of people held in detention at various parts of Iraq. We don't know where they are held. We don't know for how long they are held. We don't know why they are held. We've all seen the television pictures of families wanting to know where their loved ones and friends have disappeared. And of course, we now have the almost comical situation of President Bush telling us last night that Iraq has become the global center of the terrorism network. astonishing, because just a year ago, there wasn't any such situation, and it was all so predictable. I spent yesterday afternoon an hour or so reading the evidence of Lord Wright to the House of Commons Select Committee on Foreign Affairs, in which he predicted absolutely that this is what is going to happen, and I commend you to read that. How on earth have we got ourselves into this situation? Now, of course, I agree very much with a point made by Chris. There is no formal legal connection between the decision to use force in Iraq and the conditions under which the occupation is to take place. There can be no disagreement with that fundamental precept of international law. But that does not mean that the two have nothing to do with each other. And I think they do have something to do with each other, because it's abundantly clear to many observers across the political spectrum, it's not a left-right issue, it's not an American issue, a British issue, a French issue, it cuts across all areas, that we have entered a new phase of, and I put it as high as this, contempt for law. There is a fundamental contempt for the rule of international law, which has emanated from the United States, and it is supported at the highest levels in the administration, and it is supported also by many of the external advisers to the administration, who have in effect contributed to a culture of lawlessness. That culture of lawlessness has created the conditions in which governments, some of them, feel able to act contrary to advice, and in which military, and I don't think it appears that it is the odd individual here or there, it appears to be systematic across the board, in which there is a direct connection flowing from President Bush's abandonment of various multilateral conventions through to the so-called war on terrorism, the decision to establish a holding camp off United States territory precisely in order to avoid the application of American constitutional law and international law, straight into Abu Ghraib prison. It is seamless, it is connected, and it is about saying we suspend the rule of law. Now, that deplorable situation has not come about by accident. It is not a situation in which we have stumbled into some legal black hole. It is systematic. President Bush came into office with an avowed commitment to reshape the international legal order. It was called a la carte multilateralism. You just pick the bits that you like and you get rid of the rest. Kyoto, the ABM Treaty, the International Criminal Court, the list is not a short one. And then along came, in a sense, the most wonderful opportunity to create a framework within which to unmake the established international legal order, September the 11th. September the 11th was a shocking event. I happened to be in New York on that day with Tom Frank, and we spent the morning together. It was an absolutely shocking and devastating moment. But, and it's not fashionable to thus say this, one has to put 9/11 into context. 3,000 people died on September 11th in the World Trade Center. That is an appalling number. But around the world, there are conflicts taking place in Congo, and Uganda, and elsewhere, where literally millions of people are dying in far worse conditions and in far more abject circumstances. And it has not caused us somehow to seek to suspend the application of the rule of law internationally. I've now spent quite a lot of time going through news reports, through Lexis, precisely what happened after 9/11 in terms of a commitment to international law. And you can find literally dozens of examples of people in government, Assistant Attorney General John Yoo, Vice President Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Ruth's colleague on the Defense Policy Studies Board, Richard Perl. Great, we can remake international law. We can have a war in Iraq, and we can get rid of the United Nations. This is part of a structured proposal to remake the international legal order in flagrant violation of the established principles which Chris very correctly, and I have no differences at all with the approach that he and Françoise have taken. And the documents to support that are beginning to emerge. If you go onto the Newsweek website, you can find the memorandum from the White House legal counsel, Mr. Gonsalves, who talks about the quaint provisions of the Geneva Conventions. If we were to suspend them, he writes, we would be able to, quote, preserve military flexibility, end of quote. And that is in the memorandum. Secretary of State Colin Powell reacts and is then effectively overridden by a raft of other views. And that transforms into a policy which took us to Guantanamo Bay, which in a sense became a testing ground for all of these issues. I endorse entirely points made by Chris about the designation of individuals as unlawful combatants. It's absolutely inconsistent with the international legal order to basically say people are to be held in this legal black hole. How did we get to that position? Well, Ruth referred to the application of, I think what she called, the Geneva Convention full tilt, or the principles of Geneva. Now, I'm sorry, Ruth, I have a real problem with what appears on its face to be a minor semantic difference, but effectively says that with a minor quirk, the law no longer applies. It's through generosity of spirit, through public relations needs, that one looks to the spirit of the principles, one looks to the spirit of the conventions, but one says that actually, formally, they don't apply. And through that semantic twist, you take yourself into the non-law area. And that is what has happened. And that has led directly to Abu Ghraib. And it is reflected at the highest level. I remember watching a press conference with President Bush and Prime Minister Blair, at which President Bush, with the Prime Minister standing next to him, said, in response to a question from a British journalist, how can you hold people indefinitely at Guantanamo Bay? On what legal basis are you able to do that? And President Bush looked at the camera and said, these are bad men. These are... these are bad men. These are killers. Well, five of the bad men and five of the killers were released back into the United Kingdom. They're now living, some of them, in Tipton and elsewhere. They have not been charged. They are not subject to legal constraints. They spent 2 years incarcerated, and they are now talking about the conditions of their incarceration. And the conditions of their incarceration are not a million miles from what we have had described in relation to Abu Ghraib. What's Britain done in relation to all of this? Some would say that Britain is colluding in all of this. I'm yet to find any statement from a British government minister setting out clearly what the British government's position is in relation to the minimum standards of treatment which are to be applied in relation to the detainees at Guantanamo. We've seen expressions of reservation, expressions of regret, expressions of concern, but the failure to define publicly how British nationals should be treated at Guantanamo Bay sends out a very clear signal that it is entirely appropriate to treat these people as they have been treated, and they have been interrogated, we know that, it is not now challenged, under conditions which are not a million miles away from what has happened at Abu Ghraib. Now, all of this is very serious, but all of this comes home because at the end of the day, it boils down to individuals who have contributed to this policy. And I listened carefully to my good friend Ruth, and I have to say, over the last couple of weeks, through the diligent work of one of my research assistants, I've dug up your op-ed pieces, and you've written an awful lot of them. And I've plowed my way through them, and I commend you for the number, if not necessarily the content. But the totality of this material is that it reads like a defense statement, that this is fine. Guantanamo is fine. It's fine to hold people indefinitely in Iraq because they are bad people. And I think that we really need to ask ourselves what our role is at this moment in contributing to the situation that we are in. Let me conclude with some words that I also managed to dig up that read as follows, and I quote, "Let me finally say a few words about criminal responsibility of leadership. A leader who orders a crime is responsible under the law, just as is the operative who carries it out. This idea is central to the law of armed conflict. and is recognized in the statutes of the international tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. Command responsibility says that a leader is liable for failing to control the notorious conduct of his subordinates. He can be criminally liable even if there is no proof that he directly ordered an atrocity. As a superior in the chain of command, he must assure that his subordinates do not run amok. He has an affirmative duty to monitor their conduct and a duty to take steps to prevent and to repress misbehavior. Now, I wonder whether those words are familiar, because they are taken from your statement, Ruth, before the United States Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs in relation to a different leadership, the Iraqi leadership. But I think the words apply equally to the leadership in the Department of Defense in the United States at the moment. And it strikes me as extraordinary that in the United States today, the Secretary of State can continue to serve in office in light of everything that has come out. I hope, for my part, that such a thing could not happen in the United Kingdom in the event that similar facts were to emerge. Thank you.
In the wholly exceptional circumstances arising out of the last talk, I think it's fair, and I mean that seriously, that I think it's fair to give Ruth a couple of minutes, and then, of course, we have an opportunity for everybody here to engage, and the speakers to engage. But I think, in light of what we've heard, Ruth, if you could, just a couple of minutes.
With proportionate and necessary response, if I may. That will be my Usin Bella rule for my response. I was a Democrat by rearing, trade union Democrat, voted for Bill Clinton both times, I think. And indeed, 2001 and Osama bin Laden made a fundamental difference in my life. Too old to have any political ambition, Philippe, but really rather out of fear, a grounded fear for the democratic countries. And I take the point that one does not lightly discard the black letter rules of the law in any circumstance. And I think there may be indeed an organizational corporate culture lesson from Abu Ghraib, that if you're trying to teach a big organization with thousands of actors, hundreds of thousands of actors, what to do, that maybe you need to keep the heuristic and just make the exceptions to it, even if the exceptions will be considered illegal by some law professors. But let me tell you where I differ fundamentally, I think, with this lecture you've just heard. Number one, if you're going to take international law seriously, its content matters. Its content matters. Parliament passes stupid laws. The Congress passes stupid laws. The fact that something's done in treaty form does not necessarily mean it's sacrosanct. It's not positivist. We're not positivists. We're all naturalists. And you can have conferences that go off the mark or that get it wrong. Kyoto, Richard Cooper, professor of economics at Harvard, David Victor, the Council on Foreign Relations, think that Kyoto has significant problems in trying to render pollution avoidance into the form of property rights. ABM, with North Korea, and I will get to the heart of your artichoke in a moment, with ABM, with the new threat of North Korea having the capacity to hit the West Coast, there is now a significant interest among a great many countries, including Japan, in what was, in my democratic youth, considered a laughable proposition of ever having anti-ballistic missile defense. But for a few, it was considered bad in the Cold War because it could destabilize the Russian-U.S. relationship or the Soviet-Allied relationship. But if you have a state that has very few missiles and irresponsible leadership, as I think we would surmise that Kim Jong-il is, then having the ability to thwart it may be of interest. So even old arms controllers like Tom Graham, who was General Counsel of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, are newly interested in after ABM. So I don't think it's fair to equate the decision not to join particular treaties or to terminate a treaty under changed circumstances to be a contempt for law or a la carte multilateralism. In the case which was put before us of the war against Al-Qaeda, or the, whatever you wish to call it, the conflict against Al-Qaeda,
what is changed in ethical discourse and has to affect how the law evolves, I think, is catastrophic terrorism. Not any old terrorism, not LTTE, not the IRA, not the Basques, not the old days of killing 5 or 10 or 50 or 100. The fear of Al-Qaeda is if you have a group of jihadists or whoever who have as their preferred instrument of the destruction of innocent human lives weapons of mass destruction, if you have an actual ambition to acquire private ownership of a nuclear weapon, that might make a difference in how you craft your legal regime or how you read it. So I don't think it's fair to put this into jokes about Texas or George Bush or the American barbarians who were unilateral. No one asked to have a post-World War II balance of power in which Germany and Japan were disabled from applying what would otherwise be their proportionate contribution to defense globally because of their historical past. I mean, the logical stanchions of regional security in terms of their economic power in Europe would be Germany and Asia would be Japan, but they're not able to fulfill those roles yet because of the past. And that's what leads to the asymmetry of power of 25% of the economy versus countries that have 5%. So I don't think it's also fair to ascribe the near monopoly, if you will, of a military force on some kind of decadennial conspiracy on the part of Democrats and Republicans alike.
Maybe we can integrate the audience into it.
Well, let me just say one more thing. I don't want to talk. One last,
no.
If I may. Yeah. I do take personal exception to some of Philippe's comments. I think the importance is to figure out a way that is respectful of the rights of everyone involved. At Guantanamo, there is now, and I'm not ashamed, in fact, I thought it was my obligation to contribute to it, now a new release procedure to examine the future dangerousness of people who've been detained on the battlefield. And that's not funny. It's not funny at all. There is a... Okay, if you wish, I'll go back to New York and not debate this further.
Secondly,
I think the administration was far too slow in making it public, but there were careful checks and balances administratively on determining identity. Third, I think the original intention was to have criminal trials for everybody who was detained at Guantanamo. And to that effect, such well-known neoconservatives as Lloyd Cutler, White House counsel to President Clinton and Carter, Bill Coleman, who was a black American who fought in the Battle of the Bulge, and others who do not fit any stereotype that might be propounded, thought it was helpful to give advice to Donald Rumsfeld on how to best update the law of armed conflict in respect of having military commission trials. So I think it's, if indeed national security, which in my town growing up was simply something that was seen to be a free good because others would take care of it, if there was no dilemma in life, then there'd be no debate. But I do think that to discuss this dispassionately, what do you do about a group that seemingly wishes to kill innocent civilians en masse, not 3,000, but 300,000. That's something that democracies have to come to terms with and think about soberly in how the law should be adapted.
Okay, thank you very much, Ruth. Thank you. I'm gonna have to start asking you to cut out the applause because we do want to have quite an audience participation. I'm going to be quite strict on you. I've already seen one person at the back here. But before we move into the audience, I think we do need to hear from the International Committee of the Red Cross, who are actors in this in many, many ways. And Emanuela, the microphone has been brought down. If you would, just a few comments on what you've heard, perhaps, or independent assessment. Emanuela Chiara Gillard, legal advisor to the ICRC.
Thank you very much. I don't plan to step into the fray of Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib because I think the ICRC has been in the public debate sufficiently in the past few days. What I do want to say with regard to both those situations is that once you do have a situation that factually amounts to armed conflict or to occupation, international humanitarian law applies, and it applies in its entirety, and it is not possible to pick and choose which provisions to apply. A second point is Françoise asked me perhaps whether I agreed or whether what the ICRC's position was with regard to the hostilities that are currently taking place in Afghanistan. Obviously, the ICRC does qualify every situation of violence to determine whether it amounts to an armed conflict in order to see whether IHL is applicable and whether we have a role to play. It's not our role, however, to inform the world of this, and neither is our qualification binding. At this stage, I'd just like to point out that you analyzed the situation in Afghanistan and said, as we have currently one state involved in hostilities against a group which is not a state, you find it difficult to see how the law of international armed conflict can regulate those hostilities. And I agree with you. The law of international armed conflict regulates conflicts between nations. It's not a geographic term. Therefore, if you don't have two states involved, the law of international armed conflict cannot apply. Another point I'd like to make with regard to what was being discussed, I think, Françoise, you kind of raised a question about what about the fighting in Fallujah? What would that be? Would it be covered by the rules regulating international armed conflict? And just as a point of law, what I'd like to highlight is that Additional Protocol 1, which regulates international armed conflict, is applicable in situations governed by the Geneva Conventions, therefore in situations of occupation. So as long as we have an occupation on the ground in Iraq, Additional Protocol 1 would be applicable to it. I realize neither the US nor Iraq have ratified it, but it's just to give you an indication of what would be the applicable body of law. And it would be the applicable body of law regulating international conflict, many of which rules are now part of customary law and therefore binding of all states, regardless of ratification. I think you gave me 3 minutes. There was just one point I wanted to raise. These are just answers. The title was Current Problems and Future Prospects. There was one current problem, current issue, which no one has really addressed and which I just wanted to put before you today, which is about the role of private companies in Iraq. It's something that we have seen in the past. I think what is unprecedented on this occasion is the number of the private companies involved. From unofficial sources, it appears that there is between 15 and 20,000 private contractors there. After the U.S. Army, that is the largest group of foreign actors on the ground. And also what is unprecedented is the nature of the activities which they're carrying out, which really do on occasions amount to taking a direct part in hostilities. And just some points I'd like to make is they're often described as civilians, which would mean that they cannot be targeted. Yes, they're not members of the armed forces. However, we also need to look at what are they actually doing in the ground. Does it amount to taking a direct part in hostilities? And for many of these private companies, it does appear that they're really providing important support, logistical and actual support to the military operations, which does amount to taking a direct part in hostilities, which means that they can be targeted. So we've got to be very careful that when we look at the role of these actors and not assume that just because they're labeled civilians because they're not members of the armed forces, they cannot be targeted. Also, a word of warning for them when they head out in the field, and the reality is many of them are wearing military uniforms, which really doesn't help them in any way. The other point I'd like to make very, very quickly is with regard to the responsibility. I think this was highlighted by someone on the panel. The responsibility remains with the occupying powers. They can't divest themselves of their responsibilities by hiring contractors. They remain responsible. They also are responsible for the activities, for the violations that these private companies may commit, and I'm speaking in the abstract now. And also, I think what is not adequately addressed today, but I understand the CPA is drafting regulations for licensing private companies in the future, is the individual responsibilities of the contractors themselves. They're immune from Iraqi law. It's very difficult for them to be brought, to be held accountable abroad because of an extraterritoriality element. So in drafting the future regulations for licensing these private contractors, I think it's important that minimum rules of engagement be drafted so that these private contractors respect the law, and also that there be a system of accountability. My last 2 minutes, future prospects.
Very last, one sentence.
Future prospects.
One sentence.
What's going to happen after 30th of June? No one has addressed it. We at the ICRC have obviously got to think about it, because we've got to determine, is it going to be a situation of occupation? Does IHL apply? What are the rules? And it's very difficult to determine what the situation is, because quite frankly, we don't know what the Iraqi authority is going to look like, its relationship with the current occupying powers, and also the reality on the ground. If we turn to the law, there's some things that are very, very clear. For example, in fact, there's one thing that's very, very clear, which is that persons who are currently deprived of their liberty will retain the rights that they currently have under the Third and the Fourth Geneva Convention until they are released. That is the one thing that is very clear. With regard to the application of the law afterwards, will it continue to be an occupation? It's going to depend on the facts on the ground. If you look at IHL, it doesn't define occupation. It just says occupation extends to territory actually placed under the authority of a hostile army. Will we continue to have a hostile army after 30th of June, according to the Iraqis? Will it be exercising effective control? And it's a question that needs to be looked at both in terms of the legislation and the relationship between the Iraqi entity and the troops on the ground. And we've got indications, and I'll stop right now. And
thank you very much. Thank you. I think I'm sorry to appear to truncate that presentation, I'm really sorry, and it focused on future prospects, which are very important, but we need some international rules of engagement. We want to have our drink at the end, and we want to get home, and we have an audience that I'm sure wants to contribute. I am going to be draconian in my implementation of the rules. Your name, and if you have an affiliation, your affiliation. Please, at this stage, a question. I don't think we can really have long speeches, and I'm afraid, I'm not sure I'm going to have a preemptive strike and shut you up before you start, but I'll be pretty strict. I've already found three people gender and locationally organized. The first at the back is Professor Fred Halliday, who's right beside the microphone. The second is Claire O'Brien, and the third is a gentleman up at the back whose hand is now up. Fred.
Okay, Fred Halliday, former director of the Human Rights Center, indeed, and commend you on this wonderful evening. Three points or questions. First of all, the abuse in Abu Ghraib clearly has several causes. But two questions I'd like the panel to address. We have seen the softening up, the brutalization before intelligence. We have seen nothing, no photographs, no reports of what's actually happened in the interrogation itself. If you think of the Battle of Algiers, the film about torture in Algeria, you actually saw what happened in interrogation. My worry, and I wonder if you share it, is that all the focus on the pre-interrogation abuses has distracted attention from the thundering silence of investigation and reportage on the interrogation itself. Secondly, the question is often asked, and was asked rightly in America after September the 11th, why do they hate us? But let us ask the question, why do we despise them? What is it about people in the West that they have such contempt? And we see it in many different ways, and this isn't specific to the US at all. Ruth, don't worry, it's throughout the Western world. Towards people from the third world, not just Muslims, that we treat them in this way. And I have to say, although I'm a deep opponent of atavism, primordialism, Connor and I come from a country where this is invoked quite a bit, isn't there a legacy of colonialism here which we've not addressed? The second point is, can we do more to put this in a universal context? It's all very well to say these people have betrayed American values. They've violated international law. That surely is the point, not American traditions, American this, American that, which I'm fine on a good day. But America has bad traditions like every other country, so it's not a point of reference, moral or legal. And yet the argument is wrongly phrased. Secondly, let us remember that Iraq itself espouses universal values. They want the last surviving signatory of the UN Charter of 45 was an Iraqi, Fadl Jamali. I met him walking in Highgate Woods about 5 years ago with his sons. What do they want in Fallujah? They want independence. They're not talking about religion. They want independence. They want human rights. They want equality. And yet the whole thing has been put in this cultural form. And finally, can we do something in this country about the fact that one of the places where people are being held is Diego Garcia, which is technically British territory? Not so mentioned as Guantanamo, one or two other places. But it seems to me that would be a point. Finally, one small point to Ruth. The ICRC is not an NGO, as the colleague was too polite to say. But if you go to Geneva and say that, they'll bite your head off. They're an international organization governed by treaty.
Thank you very much. Now, I told you not to applaud. There's a gentleman right at the back, and then we have a person at the center here, sir. And your name and affiliation, if relevant.
My name is Evan Price. I'm a retired soldier, and I'm now a barrister in practice in London.
And have you got your microphone on, Edward?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Professor Sand refers to a rejection of the rule of law, particularly concentrating on his criticism on the United States. I'm not sure that's fair. Let's have a look at a moment at the UK. We have a Home Secretary who views judgments of the court as with contempt. He reviews the judges with contempt. We have a prime ministerial edict without discussion with cabinet, changing our constitutional rules. We have Belmarsh, where we have the suspension of habeas corpus. We have legislation that extends and excludes the right of appeal in the sake of to the courts with regard to asylum seeker. The fact that the US has established their Belmarsh at Guantanamo and therefore outside the US really means that the US has a healthy regard within their own territory of the rule of law. I'm not so sure the same can be said of our own government. Is not the reality that it is a failure of our political leaders to consider what it was really likely to occur post the invasion of Iraq and the collapse of the regime that pre-existed that the cause of the problems we face now?
Thank you very much. I told you, quiet. Claire O'Brien, Centre, caught my eye earlier. Thank you very much for that.
Yes, I just wonder what the panel think, but particularly Chris, given his historical proximity to some of these issues, and because of the very detailed answer and textured and qualified answer that you gave to the question of the application of the European Convention on Human Rights in Iraq to the activities of British troops there, what the panel think could have led Adam Ingram last week to say that in the government's best judgment, the European Convention did not apply, period, and what they think of that.
Thank you. I should have said we will be coming back to all of the panel by way of wrap-up, so they're making detailed notes. I apply this in an arbitrary geographic way, and we have a lady whose hand is now up on the top left hand, and then we have a gentleman at the front here, and then we have the gentleman in the red coat there. As quick as you can, please.
Vicky Hawkins from Médecins Sans Frontières. I have a question to the panel on the tension that is inherent in the Fourth Geneva Convention between the responsibility of the occupying power to offer, to look after the population that are in the territory under their control, which is simultaneous with the responsibility to allow independent and unhindered access to impartial humanitarian agencies. We are confronting tensions with this in Iraq, whereby the responsibility of the occupying power to offer assistance can lead to them to take up the coordination role. And at the same time, we also find it difficult to request them to assume this legal responsibility, while at the same time requesting that the assistance that they offer is clearly distinct and separate from the assistance that organizations like MSF offer. And this tension is resulting in organizations leaving Iraq or accepting to operate under the protection of coalition forces. So it's that tension that I would like.
Thank you very much. I'm sure the panel will agree to divvy this up among themselves. We have this gentleman at the front here. We're going to be running for another few minutes, so there'll be two or three more. I'm sorry to land all this on your panel, but it seems the best way to do it at this time. Sir.
Thank you very much. My name is Ivor Frank. I'm a barrister from Charter Chambers in London, and I do a considerable amount of human rights work. My question to the panel is, and particularly to Professor Sands, is the United Kingdom not simply failing to define publicly how British nationals should be treated, as has been suggested, but is there in fact more collusion than that? Because as I understand it, there is a suggestion that there is one island that the British has ceded to the Americans, where British nationals were being softened up prior to being transferred to Guantanamo Bay. And if that is the case, does that not go beyond mere, as it were, failure, a positive collusion in what is going on there? I wonder if you can shed any light on that particular matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentleman in the red overcoat, Professor Klug, and I think we've had one or two from those spaces. Is there anybody in this little space? Sir, we'll take you and then we'll wrap up.
A damn pleasure at Birkbeck College. An observation support of Philippe. I heard John Bolton to warm applause at the Federalist Society in Washington explain that in his view, and he is now Under Secretary of State, international law simply didn't exist as law at all as far as the United States Constitution was concerned. And my specific question for the panel, there is a United Nations Security Council resolution with respect to Iraq under debate at the moment. It has a very short sentence in it, according to the draft on the BBC website, dealing with the topic we are discussing this evening. How should we evaluate the new Security Council resolution on Iraq with respect to the question we are debating this evening? What should be in that resolution?
Thank you very much. We're going to have three more. We have Professor Klug, we have the gentleman who's been trying to get in since the start, to my missed, and we had a gentleman up there, and we're going to have to wrap it up with observations from the panel at that point. Francesca Klug.
Francesca Klug, Centre for the Study of Human Rights. Ruth Wedgwood said we are not positivists. Compared the Geneva Convention to a constitution, and said it should be interpreted. Now, I'm not sure who she meant by we, but assuming she meant at the very least her and me, then I can agree we are not positivists. But isn't the point not the Geneva Convention needs interpreting, but but who, or rather, which body is in power to interpret it?
Thank you. And the gentleman here, penultimate, with the final speaker up there on the left-hand side. Sir.
James String, Legal Action Against War. I'd like to question Professor Greenwood on his assertion that because the war may or may not have been legal, didn't necessarily mean the occupation was illegal. Surely if a criminal steals your equipment and then starts using it illegally, both are illegal acts. Admittedly, we haven't tried this in the courts yet, but we have a case in the International Criminal Court against the government on the actual war on Iraq, and if that were found against them, it would surely make the occupation of a country that was illegally attacked illegal too.
Thank you very much. And our final comment from the floor. The microphone is now being passed through to the gentleman. And, sir, you've got the floor.
Hi, Ralph Wilde, UCL. Just to really firm up the question that we had earlier about Adam Ingram's statement about the applicability of the ECHR to the UK in Iraq, we do really know what Adam Ingram was thinking when he made that statement. He explained what he meant. He said that, on the one hand, the UK, despite almost 9,000 troops, doesn't exercise effective control in any area of Iraq, and therefore those troops don't come within the UK's jurisdiction. It would seem that that particular line of argument would seem difficult to sustain, and we've heard Françoise's explanation of the definition of jurisdiction, which in any event doesn't only cover effective control. What I'd like to ask the panel is about the other alternative argument that Ingram made, which was the Bankovic espace juridique argument, which Chris referred to. Ingram said that because the convention only applies within the legal space of convention states, as Iraq is not a party to the convention, the convention is not applicable to the activities of a convention state in Iraq or outside the legal space of the convention. I just wondered what the panelists, in particular Chris and Françoise, thought of that argument. Does it hold weight? Is Ingram correct? And if so, what about Ocalan in Kenya? What about the ESA cases, which of course related the cases that related to Iraq itself, where the court seems to suggest that, in fact, the convention does apply outside the legal space of the Council of Europe.
Thank you very much, Ralph. I'm going to go in reverse order, so I'm going to ask our final speaker, Philippe, to start the responses from the panel. It's going to be difficult, of course. We're running pressed against time, but do what you can, Philippe.
Firstly, just to respond very briefly to Ruth's response. I think, I mean, plainly there is a very serious issue. Ruth is absolutely right. There is a very serious issue that we do face, a fundamental question, and I am not starry-eyed about what some of the individual concerned are up to, what they intend to do, how they would like to do it. One has to be realistic that there is a real threat. However, I don't think you throw the baby out with the bathwater, and the reaction which has been wrought is, I think, a massive overreaction. It may simply be that some of us in this room grew up in London in the 1970s and had IRA bombs going off here and there, and it had a sort of sensitizing effect which enabled us to put it in perspective. But I don't underestimate at all that we have a very real question to ask ourselves about the extent to which our legal order, domestic and international, is able to accommodate a new reality. That is a fundamental challenge, and I agree absolutely with Ruth. Where we disagree is in the response to those issues. I'm not going to answer all of the questions.
Please.
Just take a couple. Yeah.
I didn't mean that sarcastically.
There's been a couple of questions about Diego Garcia, is the reference, and we simply don't know what the facts are. I certainly don't know what the facts are. There has been a lot in the press that there is speculation, there is no hard evidence, there is no hard material. But to the extent that the speculation has a grain of truth in it, then it would raise some very fundamental questions, as do the circumstances in which some of the British detainees have been, if you like, captured outside of Afghanistan in third countries and transported apparently
with the support of the United Kingdom, into the hands of the United States. That is an analogous situation, and plainly it raises fundamental questions, and Ralph's assessment, I think, points to a very clear answer of what the European Convention on Human Rights is going to deal with in that situation. The points made by Fred Halliday, I think, go to the heart of the issue. We live in a different world today than we did 50 years ago in this sense. There is now a dense body of rules of international law which enable us, if you like, to leave our own legal territory and enter a domain in which there are applicable international rules that don't govern every situation, but enable us to create a framework and a context to determine the circumstances in which actions may be perceived to be legitimate. And I think to understand another way of summarizing the argument that I put is that there is a reaction in the United States against the emergence of that legal system, new legal context, and a relocation domestically. You find it, for example, in the opinion of Judge Scalia in the United States Supreme Court, where he says, we will not look at foreign law in interpreting the Constitution. And that is part of, I think, the same mindset. It is a resistance to look beyond national boundaries in a legal sense. And I think the great challenge from within the United States is what happens in the coming period in terms of its ability to resituate itself in the global context, because at the end of the day, we have to remember, irony of ironies, that the internationalized context which we now have exists largely due to the efforts of the United States, of President Roosevelt and then President Truman, in the extraordinary period beginning with the Atlantic Charter in 1941 and culminating in 1949 with the Geneva Convention. The United States was the driving force to that transformation, and my strong hope is that it will return in due course to those roots.
Thank you, Philippe. Ruth.
Well, not to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, but I just wanted to note for the record that the administration now is proposing to ratify the law of the Sea Convention. the Senate willing, but it hasn't yet gone through the Senate.
So that the warships can enter the territorial waters.
Can we have an end to the...
There's always a way to look at it.
Can we have an end to the responses, to the responses, to the responses, to the responses, please, Professor Sands?
Well, let me just, first on who should interpret Geneva. I'm actually going to teach next fall with the wonderful Christophe Giraud, who's the head of the ICRC in Washington, and I'm sure we'll have a lively course. Perhaps, as happens in the UN committee, with surprising degrees of concurrence rather than difference. On who interprets Geneva, it actually used to be a real specialist's area. People who wanted tenure didn't teach it. And you would be surprised, and among the old salts who have been the Geneva authorities, Fritz Karlshoven or Leslie Green of Holland or Leslie Green of Canada, you get a surprising amount of dissensus, even on what Geneva means. So Karlshoven and Green do not agree, for example, that Geneva 3 and 4 are seamless. They do think there's such a thing as unlawful combatants who still have human rights but are not covered by Geneva 4. So I think one should not suppose that there is necessarily a determinacy in the rules as opposed to the principles of law just because it's international, and particularly when it's being applied to new circumstances. On the question about incorporation of applicable international law into domestic law, an issue for a great many countries, most countries are dualist. I think actually the ICJ now is coming up against the shoals of senses of sovereignty because it's telling particular organs of particular governments that they should be the ones to incorporate international law. And federal states in particular, Australia, Canada, Germany, US, have some real problems in creating the ability to get conformance to international standards when, in fact, their sub-state actors have surprising degrees of autonomy. I have, in the rest of my heterodox life, Philippe, taken the view that it would be, in fact, useful to have states join, subnational groups join human rights conventions so that they would both share the liability as well as the ability to violate those conventions. On the particular instance, there is a 1996 War Crimes Act passed by the statute, but by the Congress, which in fact creates federal district court jurisdiction over criminal violations of the Geneva Convention. So in fact there is applicable operative law here. And Fred Halliday's remarks were very interesting. I share the concerns. I think one of the reasons that it's so hard to get a handle on this is, frankly, I have no... The real smart guys in this, I think, are the old military folks who've lived with Geneva III and Geneva IV in the circumstances of the Korean War and World War II and other conflicts, who have a sense of what is considered rules of the road among democratic, responsible armed forces. It's hard to read in context what some of the rules mean. I mean, again, my version of a humane interrogation in a criminal law context is, would you like to speak to me if you want a lawyer? End of conversation. In Geneva, in World War II, which is pre-Geneva, but still the ethos of Geneva, Geneva 29, could you continue the conversation? Could you raise your voice? Could you offer rewards for cooperating? I do think that among academic lawyers, we don't always know the sense of what is responsible behavior. One of the reasons why, in my little op-ed, I propose that we should indeed return, if we have lapsed from the practice of having a JAG officer, a judge advocate general, on hand in every major interrogation center, including ones that are run jointly by intelligence agencies and military folks, to make sure that that ground level sense of decency is preserved. The difference between a clear case, a gray zone, and a red line, which I think really the operational people can best often apprise. And that's it, I guess. I would like to say that I do think if you're going to take international law seriously, the content matters as well as the process of formation. And it is the case that there is a particular difficulty in this era in the formation of international law. Call it hegemon, call it abandonment of function on the part of Europe, but international law may be easiest to form consensually when you have states of relatively equal power that see in each other their own problems and dilemma. And I do think the U.S., not surprisingly, Democrat and Republican alike, wonder how to cope, how to operate politically in an environment where oftentimes the security function in terms of transcontinental operations is one that may fall particularly to them. My joke with my French friends, since I just came back from the Sorbonne, is that, in fact, the French and the Americans are more alike than not. They both have rather the same attitude toward power, just one speaks of it and one doesn't. but I do think that, in fact, there are problems with law formation in an asymmetric circumstance, both because the hegemon may be tempted to excess and because the non-hegemons may be at times attempted to, dare I be provocative in my last word, free riding on a function that the, may I make a Jewish joke, and I finally for Hoffa, the Shabbos goy, the guy who pushes the elevator because you can't do it on Sabbath, but he can dirty his finger pushing the button. I do think there's a worry that if security becomes a function of only one state, and I'm talking about local security, but kind of, and I'm not talking about human security. I'm simply speaking of the problems of what happens if North Korea goes sour or other similar situations. Okay. That it's not healthy to have only one state that takes that as its responsibility. So I'm all in favor of the European Rapid Reaction Force.
Thank you, Fran. Francois.
Right, thanks. First of all, what's wrong with being a positivist? I reckon I'm 90% positivist. I'm a human rights lawyer with the mentality of a tax lawyer, and I don't see what's wrong with it. Ruth mentioned the War Crimes Act. One of the reasons given in the Gonzales memo for saying that the Geneva Convention didn't apply was to avoid the application of the War Crimes Act, which I think needs to be borne in mind. If I'm to merge several of the questions that were asked, I completely agree with those who question what the Home Secretary has done. The job of Home Secretary ought to carry with it a health warning. Whatever you go in as, you end up being affected. But I get the impression, putting everything together, that you're saying we should move the U.S. out of Diego Garcia and put everybody from Belmarsh in Diego Garcia. I'm not sure that will work. If we are responsible for what's going on in Diego Garcia, doesn't that mean Cuba is responsible for what's going on in Guantanamo Bay? I'm not sure you can separate those out, but I completely agree with the comments that were made with regard to Belmarsh. Remember that the Commissioner for Human Rights of the Council of Europe has said that the derogation wasn't valid. I'm sure that the Belmarsh detentions will find their way to Strasbourg. It will be interesting seeing what happens there. On the point that was made about the role of private companies and them. I think it's much more complicated than that. There's all sorts of roles being played by individuals, not members of the armed forces. All I'll say there is watch this space. Report will be submitted to the subcommission this year, because for 3 years, the issue of individual criminal responsibility of foreign personnel in any such operations, it's easy for the military. There's problems with all the rest. There's problems with CIFPOL. There's problems with private contractors. There's problems with civilians loosely attached to the armed forces. There's problems with international civil servants who end up screwing the local girls. CSAT is independent. Sorry, today's independent, I think. I think one issue that hasn't been mentioned at all and which is really important, it's been touched on, is the question of transfers. Under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, under the Convention Against Torture, under the European Convention on Human Rights, a state is not allowed to transfer a person to a state where there's reasonable reason to believe that they're going to be subject to torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. That means that when the United States transfers people to Morocco, Egypt, Syria, etc., in order that they can be tortured, that's unlawful. It means, I would suggest, in the light of recent evidence, that when any government transfers someone with a view to that person going to Guantanamo Bay or some base in Afghanistan, there are serious question marks. And the number of states who are transferring people without access to any form of legal machinery is incredible. It's not just the UK. There's Yemen, there's Bosnia-Herzegovina, in defiance of their court judgments, etc., etc. An awful lot of states are currently transferring people to US custody, not for US custody in the United States, but outside the United States, and I think that's a problem that should be looked at. On the applicability of the European Convention on Human Rights, I need to come clean. Whoever asked one of the questions clearly was aware of the fact that Chris Greenwood was the representative of the 17 governments. I hope they all paid him. One of the legal representatives of the applicants. I was also the original legal representative of the applicants in ESA. I can tell you, which is not clear from the court judgment in ESA, the issue of jurisdiction was pleaded by the applicants in ESA. The Turkish government then made no comment about it at all, and neither did the court in its admissibility decision, original admissibility decision. The incident concerns the killing of people who weren't in a place of detention. It was Iraqi shepherds who had simply been stopped, talked to, moved around a bit, and then shot. That's going to be hugely relevant, obviously, for the question of espace juridique, but also for how do you reconcile, say, the original admissibility decision in ESA and Bankovic. ESA is currently before the Grand Chamber. It looks as if they've adopted a completely novel procedure of reopening an admissibility decision. The most important paragraph, I would suggest, in Bankovic is paragraph 37 of the admissibility decision, in which the British government, speaking on behalf of all 17 states, so you can use an estoppel argument against Norway and France if anyone here is representing the individuals who brought a case against Norway and France arising out of the situation in Kosovo. They said they treated as axiomatic that any detention effected outside national territory by state forces, whether they be military or police, was obviously bringing people within the jurisdiction. Therefore, there are two issues. One, occupied territory. Two, forget occupied territory and just look at the, if you like, the Öcalan problem. Why did Adam Ingram say what he said? What the cuckoo do you expect him to say? There's a case has been started, Jabbar Karim Ali, against the Secretary of State for Defense, in which the issue of the applicability of the Human Rights Act, and therefore the European Convention on Human Rights, is there. You can hardly get him to concede his Secretary of State's legal argument. I mean, so don't push your luck too far. On the espace juridique point, I would simply say that in neither the judgment in Loisy-Dou nor in the judgment in Cyprus, Turkey, did the court say, oh, what really matters here is the fact that the people used to be bound by the convention. They only referred to that in Bankovic, looking back on Loisy-Dou. Now, Loisy-Dou was occupied territory, so it wasn't the argument about the Öcalan argument, if you like. So I don't see that the espace juridique, I think when push comes to shove, they will decide that when it's occupied territory, the espace juridique argument doesn't apply, because otherwise they're saying that, for example, United Kingdom forces could do what the cuckoo they liked outside Europe, but not inside, in which case you need to know whether today Azerbaijan is or is not in the Council of Europe to know what's going on in Nagorno-Karabakh. Get real. So with regard to occupied territory, I don't think it's espace juridique. Where it's not occupied territory, it depends on the individual control exercised over the, in, usually in this case, the detainee. In that case, you don't need to get into espace juridique. It wasn't even raised in Öcalan. And the particular cases that are part of Jabbar Karim Ali, some of them involve, one involves someone who was made to swim across a river. These are alleged facts, made to swim across a river when he couldn't swim, which is why he drowned, when he was detained. He was being taken to a hospital. Other cases involve opening fire in, if you like, open situations. Other cases involve opening fire during the course of a search. I think these are going to raise different issues. It's wrong to see it just as one case. But that decision is going to be vital, as is the ISA case before the Grand Chamber in the European Court of Human Rights, and as is the case that has been brought against Norway and France, whose nationals were at the relevant time COMCAFOR with regard to the lawfulness of detentions in Kosovo. This issue isn't going to go away, and it's not settled yet.
Thank you, Francois. And finally, finally, the person who kicks us off, winds us up, Christopher.
Thank you very much. I think the term wind up is treated in two different senses in this session. In view of what's just been said, I think I should have should point out what I failed to do in my opening remarks, which is that everything I've said here today is in my personal capacity, and those remarks that were attributed to me but were actually made by other members of the panel, and I didn't make those remarks in my personal capacity. And for precisely that reason, I'm afraid, Claire and Ralph, I'm not going to engage in the fascinating point about espace juridique, not because of historical proximity to the point, but because of the litigation that's pending at the moment. I don't think I can do that. I can, however, answer the question from the gentleman from Legal Action Against War, whose name I fear I didn't catch, about the relationship between the legality of the war and the occupation. Obviously, sir, you and I disagree about the legality of the war. I'm getting quite used to people disagreeing with me about that. But if you have a look at the decision of the United States Court in the case of US and List, the Balkan General's case, which is one of the leading case war crimes trials at the end of World War II, you find precisely that point considered. A prosecution argument that the illegality of Germany's invasion of Yugoslavia rendered everything done during the occupation unlawful was rejected unanimously by the tribunal in that case. And I have to say, I think that that view is quite right. And the analogy you draw with stolen property and domestic law, I fear, simply doesn't apply in the international context. And then lastly, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to agree separately with three people who've spoken today. I'd first of all like to agree with Ruth about something. When she said it's the content of international law that matters, I wholeheartedly agree. But I have to say, Ruth, I think the problem is that the content of international law is not something which is fluid for all time coming and capable of being changed whenever it suits one. The purpose of today's debate is really about the misgivings that some have over whether the content of international law is actually being complied with. Then I'd like to agree similarly with Philippe. I agree wholeheartedly with Philippe when he says that it's the greatest of pities that the United States has decided to stand outside the Kyoto and ICC treaties. But I think there's a fundamental flaw in linking allegations of a breach of the Geneva Convention, which, if they are true, are plainly illegal, with a criticism of the United States for not becoming a party to two treaties, which it's perfectly entitled not to become a party to. We can agree or disagree with that decision politically, but please, let's not confuse it with the real questions of international law about compliance with the treaties that do bind the United States. And lastly, I'd like to agree with Fred Halliday. If I had more time, I'd agree, Fred, with virtually everything that you said. But there's one particular point I'd like to agree with, and that is that the fact that what appears to have been happening at Abu Ghraib violates international law is a lot more important than the allegation that it violates American values. But I take a rather more optimistic view of the comment that was made. The way I read the President's comment is it actually shows that there isn't the dichotomy between American values and international law, which is sometimes suggested. I think it's extremely encouraging that a violation of international law is also quite clearly a violation of the values of a democratic state like the USA.
Thank you. What I'm going to do now...
Well, I agree with Francois on just about everything.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to stop you laughing and stop you applauding, because I want to say that the event's pretty well winding down now after the wind down by Christopher. That's pretty well your lot for this public lecture series this year. I know some of you junkies can't wait till autumn. We'll have another series. I cannot think we could have ended on a higher note than that. I want to thank you as an audience. I've never seen such energy in so many hands. I want to signal out and just be delighted to see Fred Halliday here, my predecessor as director of the Centre. It's wonderful to see you here at one of your first functions with me as the director. But mainly, I want to thank these four guests and the International Committee, the Red Cross, because without the Red Cross, this event would not have taken place. Without these people, this event would not have taken place. Christopher, Philippe, Francoise, and I do have to, and make no shame about doing it, signal out Ruth Wedgwood. Ruth didn't have to come in an airplane over here. I don't know if we paid. I doubt we paid. What was it? Club class. She's heckling me and I'm trying to praise her. I want to thank her very much for coming and for coming into this audience and for expressing opinions as she did, as clearly as she did. It's very important that we engage with the United States of America, and we've had a really excellent opportunity to do so with a leading figure within public life in the United States. So to all four, and the International Committee of the Red Cross, and a sort of little perk on the applause for Ruth Wedgwood, thank you very much for coming along. Because so many of you were here, I was sort of waiting for some of you to leave. There is a drinks reception. We've sort of hidden it away because we're sort of, there's loads of you here. But if you can make your way to the fifth floor of the old building, the senior common room, there are drinks for everybody and a chance to mingle with the guests. Fifth floor, keep walking. Senior common room. Good evening.